In his 1943 essay on the primacy of the common good against the personalists, Charles de Coninck takes issue with several aspects of the doctrine of human dignity that various personalist writers at the time were advancing. One particular aspect of the new personalist doctrine that troubled de Coninck concerned friendship, namely what some personalist writers were theorizing regarding the source of the love that develops between friends. De Coninck confronts the worrisome personalist innovation with classic Thomistic teaching. He writes, quote, "Others are not the reason for the proper lovableness of the common good. Rather, others are lovable insofar as they can participate in the common good." De Coninck is speaking here specifically of the common good of the family, countering the claim by some personalist writers that the goodness and dignity of individual family members founds and causes the goodness and dignity of the family as a whole. To the contrary, de Coninck argues, the good's causality runs in the opposite direction, not from person to thing, but from thing to person. It's not the goodness of individual family members that makes the family commonly good and lovable. Rather, the members of a family become lovable to each other because they enjoy, even before they converse in familial ways, a kind of communication with each other within the same higher and common good, in this case, the good of the family. Contrary to the personalist claim that friendly relations form a family, de Coninck insists that a family forms friendly relations. The common good of the family provides both the principle and the context of the love that develops between family members and binds them together personally. The love of Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie do not make the Simpsons, de Coninck would say had he lived into the late 1980s. Rather, their being the Simpsons make it possible for Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie to love each other as relatives. Elsewhere in his essay, de Coninck makes the point, or the same point here, in reference to the common good of beatitude. He writes, quote, "The communication with the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. The common good qua common good is the root of this communication, which would not be possible were the divine good not already loved in its communicability to others." Here, de Coninck's language becomes more technical, but his purpose remains clear. He explains that to understand the conviviality, the friendship of the blessed in heaven, one must point to its source not in the saints themselves, but in the divine good. Because the blessed all love the same good as a good for all, they then love each other as lovers of the same good. As in the family, so too in heaven, de Coninck helps us to see. In the next life also, the common good founds and causes interpersonal relations of love. Friendly saints don't form heaven. Heaven forms friendly saints. The common good of beatitude provides both the principle and the context of the love that develops between the blessed and binds them together personally. The love of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do not make them the blessed, de Coninck would say. Rather, their being the blessed makes it possible for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to love each other as saints. While de Coninck highlights in his essay the community-inducing character of the common good, he spends little time in his essay describing either the metaphysics or the mechanics of the common good's community building. He assures the reader of his argument's Thomistic foundation, but he does not pinpoint the sources of his argument within St. Thomas's works. In what follows, I hope to provide these elements missing from de Coninck's presentation by placing his observations in conversation with contemporary scholarship on Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio. This scholarship confirms St. Thomas's awareness that friendship between persons requires some foundation other than the good character or will of the friends themselves. This foundation lies outside of the friends, in a social context that unites persons in some shared love or activity prior to their being united by friendly affection. As we shall see, appreciation of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio allows for a deeper comprehension of De Conic's polemic with the personalists and why he insistently applied the classical doctrine of the primacy of the common good against the personalist doctrine of the primacy of the person. At the same time, De Conic's defense of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good allows for a deeper reading of the contemporary scholarship on Thomistic communicatio. While modern scholars have helped their readers to appreciate the role that communicatio plays in Aquinas' theory of friendship, they neglect to convey Aquinas' sense that as the principle of friendship, communicatio has a principle of its own, the common good. As I will show, De Conic's review of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good complements contemporary scholarship on communicatio by showing how, for Aquinas, the common good as the principle of communicatio serves accordingly as the principle of friendship. In confirmation of this insight, I will conclude this essay by examining several texts of Aquinas in which the communicatio of the common good, while not explicitly mentioned by Aquinas in these texts, undergirds his descriptions there of various kinds of interpersonal relations. Before we begin to examine St. Thomas's doctrine of communicatio, a brief word about De Conic's argument against the personalists is in order. In The Primacy of the Common Good, De Conic reviews Aquinas' doctrine of the common good for a very specific reason: to counterpose Aquinas' teaching to a new conception of human dignity proposed by some personalist writers. De Conic judges this theory to stray dangerously from classical orthodoxy. He observes in the personalist theory that, based on a sharp distinction that some personalist thinkers make between the human creature as a material individual and the human creature as a spiritual person, they conceive of a new principle of human society. They no longer hold, like St. Thomas, that this principle rests in the common good, which the personalists deem perfective only of man's lower material individuality. They locate the principle of society instead in the generosity of man, which they assert flows naturally from man's higher spiritual personality. Accordingly, the personalists argue that human persons, qua persons, associate with each other freely and spontaneously, not because of anything that they share, but because of their natural generosity and greatness of soul. In friendship, therefore, generous like inclines to generous like. In the family and in the city, however, needy like depends on needy like. Warning of the naivete of such a social theory, De Conic points in primacy to the negative effects that such thinking could have on real societies. Though De Conic does not identify the personalist writers that he criticizes, one can find the anthropological and social ideas that he critiques in the writings of Emmanuel Mounier, the founder of French personalism. For example, Mounier employs the personalist person-individual distinction in his Personalist Manifesto. Mounier writes, quote, "Dispersion and avarice, these are the two marks of individuality. The person is marked by self-mastery and choice. He is generous. In his inner orientation, the person is turned in the exact opposite direction from the individual." Mounier theorizes here that the human being as a material individual discovers himself as a material object in a material world, thrown in and scattered among other material beings with whom he is ordered toward interacting materially, that is, in a disordered, impersonal, and even avaricious manner. As a spiritual person, however, the same human being possesses the vocation to self-possession and self-determination, and thus he is ordered toward engaging other persons like himself in a spirit of generosity. For Mounier, the person-individual distinction has implications for how we should understand human social relations. While natural to humans, life in the family and in the city has an important but limited value. It draws the material individual into material associations with other material individuals. Over and above these material associations, spiritual associations of generosity and love become possible to human beings by virtue of their spiritual personality. When later in his manifesto, Mounier describes his vision of a personalist society, he repeats his view that man's natural societies, family, city, provide him less than a fully personal life. A personalist civilization, Mounier writes, is a civilization that orients its spirit and structures toward the fulfillment of each of its constituents as persons. This civilization recognizes the reality of natural communities and their proper finality, which is different from the simple sum of individual interests and superior to the interests of the individual considered materially. Nevertheless, these natural communities have as their final end to empower each individual to live as a person, that is, to reach a maximum of initiative, of responsibility, and of spiritual living. In this passage, Mounier again identifies man's life in the family and in the city, or what he calls life in the, quote, zone of the social, as constituting part of man's material life. He asserts simultaneously that any material good is oriented to the person's spiritual good. Mounier leads his reader to the conclusion, therefore, that the individual's social life, as something material, lies beneath and is to be sublimated into the person's spiritual life. In other words, the good of one's community exists to serve the good of one's person. In Primacy, de Koninck notes how personalist descriptions of social life, like Mounier's, differ from classical conceptions of man's social flourishing. Among the differences that de Koninck notes, the most grievous is the personalist reversal of what Aquinas understood to be the ordering of man's particular good to the common good. For Mounier, the person does not rest in his end when his family or his city flourishes. Rather, his family and his city rest in their end when the individual person flourishes. It's when he emerges, the person emerges from his natural communities, their good sublimated into his particular good, more a whole to himself than a part to greater whole. According to the personalist depiction of human flourishing, de Koninck warns, the common good no longer constitutes the final cause of human flourishing. Instead, human flourishing constitutes the final cause of the common good. In staunch opposition to this view, de Koninck cautions his readers over the consequences that personalist theory might have for real societies. Families and political communities cannot long survive if the self replaces the common good as the goal and end of human social life. Mounier was not the only high-profile personalist thinker to elevate the person's particular good over the common good in this way. And Jacques Maritain's personalist thinking also, which paralleled but did not intertwine with Mounier's, the person-individual distinction features prominently. This is true especially in texts where Maritain applies his personalist thinking to political theory. In Scholasticism and Politics, for example, Maritain introduces the question of the relation of the person to society, which he calls, quote, the fundamental subject of all social and political philosophy. Here, Maritain outlines the distinction between the person and the individual. For Maritain, mastery of this distinction is prerequisite to any speculative treatment of man's political life. It is impossible to discuss without first embarking upon rather abstract philosophical considerations concerning individuality and personality, Maritain writes, two notions which are usually confused and whose distinctions I consider to be highly important. Accordingly, one finds in scholasticism and politics articulations of the person-individual distinction like the following, quote, "The human being is held between two poles, a material pole, which in reality does not concern authentic personality, but rather the material condition and the shadow, as it were, of personality, and a spiritual pole, which concerns personality itself," end of quote. Maritain takes care not to be misunderstood on this point. He clarifies that the two poles of man's identity do not create in the human creature two selves. There remains in man one self, but with two distinct principles of identity and action. Quote, "It is the same entire being, which in one sense is an individual, and in another sense a person. I am wholly an individual by reason of what I receive by matter, and I am wholly a person by reason of what I receive from spirit," end of quote. Of man's material individuality, Maritain writes, "One might say that in each of us, individuality, being in one that which excludes from one all that other men are, is the narrowness in being, and the grasping for oneself, which in a body animated by spirit derives from matter." Of man's spiritual personality, Maritain paints an opposing picture. The notion of personality does not refer to matter, Maritain writes, as does the notion of individuality apply to corporeal things. It refers to the highest and deepest dimensions of being. Personality is rooted in the spirit, insofar as the latter stands by itself in existence and superabounds in it. Maritain describes the contact of these two principles in a single human being in the following terms. Man, Maritain writes, insofar as he is a material individuality, has but a precarious unity, which wishes only to slip back into multiplicity, for matter as such tends to decompose itself. Insofar as we are individuals, each of us is a fragment of a species, a part of this universe, a single dot in the immense network of forces and influences, cosmic, ethnic, historic, whose laws we obey. We are subject to the determinism of the physical world. But each man is also a person. And insofar as he is a person, he is not subject to the stars and atoms. For he subsists entirely within the very subsistence of his spiritual soul. And the latter is in him a principle of creative unity, of independence, and of freedom. Maritain asserts in this passage, and in passages similar to it, that as a material individual, the human creature is subject to the laws of physics, biology, history, society, and all of the other laws that govern the material universe. As a spiritual person, however, the human creature soars above the stars and as an instance of creative freedom in an otherwise determined universe. Maritain's description of the polarity separating man's constitutive principles, individuality, personality, matter, spirit, could not be starker. What concerns critics like de Koninck is the way in which personalists like Maritain set the realities of human personality apart from the exigencies of human materiality. The personalist comparison of the body and soul seems always to exalt the soul to the degradation of the body. A single human soul is of more worth than the whole universe of bodies and material goods, Maritain writes. There is nothing above the human soul except God. In regard to the eternal destiny of the soul and its supertemporal goods, society exists for each person and is subordinated to it. Based on his understanding of the distinction of spirit and matter in the human being, Maritain describes the mature individual as one who surrenders to the upward thrust of his spirit in defiance of the downward pull of his matter. Maritain writes, "If the development of the human being follows the direction of material individuality, he will be carried in the direction of the hateful ego, whose law it is to snatch, to absorb for oneself. In this case, personality, as such, will tend to adulterate, to dissolve. If, on the contrary, the development follows the direction of spiritual personality, then it will be in the direction of the generous self of saints and heroes that man will be carried. Man will really be a person, insofar as the life of spirit and of freedom will dominate in him that of passion and of the senses." As in Mounier's thinking, the person-individual distinction in Maritain's thinking has the effect of sublimating the material good of the individual to the spiritual good of the person, which at the same time subordinates the common good of the individual to the particular good of the person. Social interaction, therefore, has a new purpose for Maritain, at least in comparison to Aquinas' thinking. Aquinas roots the social interaction of human beings in the common good. Like Mounier, however, Maritain roots the friendship of persons as distinct from the social associations of mere individuals in the native generosity of the human spirit. As the greatest thing in creation, the person has no choice finally but to love all things for the self, whose innate greatness stands as his temporal final end. Only God demands more love than the self. This is not a hindrance to friendship, however. The spirit's abundance of goodness spills out in generosity in a kind of self-diffusion toward the recognition and confirmation of the other. Thus, in personalist thinking, does the self become the principle of communion? In his criticism of the personalist doctrine of human dignity, which reverses the Thomistic ordering of the particular good to the common good, de Coninck could not be more forceful. He writes, "Take note of how the self-proclaimed personalist who put the person above the common good can no longer detect the link that binds persons together. Consequently, they replace this link with another, a sordid fraternity, that would immediately unite persons among themselves as if each individual were a common good for all the others. This amounts to making each citizen a tyrant. Amans ipsum magis quam civitatem, loving himself more than the city." According to de Coninck, the society idealized by personalist thinkers is sordid, for in it there exists no greater good for persons to love than the self. De Coninck argues that in such a sordid fraternity, or what we might also call a confederacy of tyrants, there can be no friendship among persons. For each person loves the common good of the family or of the city, for example, not for itself and its shareability with others, but for one's own spiritual self and the material benefit that he derives from it. Elsewhere in his essay, de Coninck describes what interpersonal relations look like in societies where everyone loves the common good as his particular good. De Coninck writes, "It is completely within the line of humanism to see the first root, the most fundamental reasons for the social character of man, not in the common good, but in the poetic nature of the individual, in the need for self-expression and self-communication under pressure from an interior superabundance of pure self." Understand then that the person of the other is necessary because I feel the need to make myself heard, because I need someone to appreciate me. I need a person subject. In short, with respect to me, your reason to be is to participate in my personal life. For de Coninck, the personalist conception of the primacy of the person proves disastrous for political theory, because it identifies no principle for the ordering of human society other than the person himself. In other words, absent a common good which members of a family or a city love as their proper and better good, each individual would have no choice but to desire and engage in the life of the family and in the life of the city in view of the next best good that he is bound in justice to love and preserve, the particular good of the self. The ruinous effect of the social aggrandizement of the particular good could not be clearer for de Coninck. As he describes above, to submit the pursuit of the common good to the pursuit of the particular good instrumentalizes not only the good of the family and the good of the city to the flourishing of the self, it instrumentalizes also all of the members of these societies to the same flourishing of the self. Others exist in personalist society, de Coninck laments, so that they might, quote, participate in my personal life. That is not community. That is tyranny. The self becomes the common good to which all others are ordered. From the Thomistic point of view, the personalist instrumentalization of the common good to the particular good effectively removes the person from, by elevating him above, the communicatio established by the common good in which and for which, according to Aquinas, persons for whom that common good is perfective interact with each other, cooperate with each other, and eventually love each other. A brief overview of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio will confirm not only de Coninck's criticism of personalist doctrine, but also his declarations repeated at the beginning of this essay that, quote, others are lovable insofar as they can participate in the common good, and also, quote, communication with the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. Thomistic scholars in the 20th century paid significant attention to Aquinas' understanding of communicatio as the foundation of friendship. In a 1986 essay, Joseph Bobick, then an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, summarized their work. He highlights, for example, the observations of Leo Bond, OP, who demonstrated that for Aquinas, similitudo between persons, similarity of both species and accidental qualities, does not suffice to found friendship. In addition to similitudo, friendship requires a certain communicatio, a certain being thrown in together in some social context. This is required to unite persons, which communicatio makes friendly conversatio between them possible. Bobick also points to Jerome Rauch's confirmation of Bond's interpretation of Aquinas' doctrine. More clearly than Bond, Rauch explains how for Aquinas communicatio as the foundation of friendship bears not the notion of personal exchange, but rather the notion of community, or the exercise of community, within which the personal exchanges of friendly conversatio can take place. In the same vein, Bobick features the scholarship of Josephus Keller, OP, who noted that in Aquinas' texts, as in Aristotle's, communicatio possesses at times an active sense and at other times, an intransitive sense. The active sense denotes the personal exchanges, social interactions, and common pursuits that constitute the activities of friendship. By contrast, the intransitive sense denotes not an active communication between friends, but rather some having in common, which centers upon something common that is simply there, as something capable of being mutually apprehended, in order thereupon to be actually mutually apprehended, then mutually valued and mutually loved. Bobick points to Keller's active intransitive distinction as particularly helpful for reading Aquinas' discussion of the kind of communicatio necessary for founding friendship. Bobick writes, quote, the context of Summa Theologiae, Secunde Secunde, question 23, article 1, makes it clear that the communicatio which functions as foundation of friendship is communicatio in the intransitive sense. In other words, the inactive communication or community of persons deriving from their sharing of some good in common It is the common diffusion of the good as a final cause that unites prerequisite to the active conversation among persons that is observed by all as the vital sign of friendship. A careful reading of Question 23, Article 1 confirms Bobick's interpretation of it. In his article, after Aquinas explains that the love of concupiscence, or the self-referential regard for the other, cannot produce friendship, he continues, quote, "But neither does well-wishing suffice to account for friendship, for certain mutual love is required, since the friend is a friend to his friend. Now such a mutual benevolence is founded on some communication, communicatio." For Aquinas, neither the self-referential love of concupiscence nor the one-sided love of benevolence suffices to establish friendship between persons. What is required is some active conversatio of mutual benevolence in which each wishes the other his good. Aquinas is quick to mention, however, that this active conversatio is not itself friendship's foundation. It is rather friendship's flourishing. The foundation on which the active conversatio of friendship rests is some other communication, or intransitive communicatio, which establishes the friends within the community of some good before they wish this good and other goods for each other. Based on his reading of Bond, Rausch, Keller, and of others, Bobick concludes that Aquinas employs the term communicatio throughout his corpus to identify three distinct realities pertaining to friendship. In each case where the term appears, context helps to determine which of the three realities Aquinas is discussing then and there. In the first instance, Aquinas employs the term communicatio to denote, according to Bobick, the social relational context which is the foundation out of which friendship arises, or at least can arise. Bobick indicates that this is the communicatio that Aristotle speaks of in the Nicomachean Ethics when he says, quote, "Every form of friendship involves association." The associations that Aristotle identifies are of two basic species: domestic, based on common blood or a common hearth, and civic, based on a common political good. For Aristotle, the two species of association possible to man serve as the foundation of various possible species of human friendship into which he may enter, namely the friendships between husband and wife, between parents and their children, between siblings, between extended relations, between fellow tribesmen, between fellow citizens, etc. Bobick identifies this first sense of communicatio, the foundation of friendship, as a passive rather than an active cause of friendship. Bobick calls it an enabling cause, or a condition within which the active cause can bring out its effect. Bobick does not mention it, but communicatio's passive causality here reveals this first kind of communicatio as a final cause of friendship. Aquinas' second manner of employing communicatio denotes, according to Bobick, the activities of friendship. This is the communicatio that Aristotle discusses elsewhere in the Nicomachean Ethics, namely where he mentions that, quote, "friendship is a partnership," implying the, quote, "living together of friends, and of all the activities that flow naturally from it, namely drinking together, gambling together, hunting together, playing sports together, studying philosophy together, to name just a few of the examples that Aristotle gives. This second kind of communicatio is the active cause of friendship that Bobick distinguishes from friendship's enabling cause. Although actively an, quote, "initiating and perpetuating cause of friendship," Bobick says the second communicatio remains, in essence, compared to the first, the proper effect of friendship. Here, communicatio's active causality reveals the second kind of communicatio as an efficient cause of friendship. Finally, Aquinas' third manner of employing communicatio, which is signaled by his use of the active verb communicare, denotes the, quote, "offering of a gift which provides a foundation where there was none, out of which friendship can arise." Popick explains what this offering of a gift entails. Whenever two persons, a superior and an inferior, have nothing in common, but the superior offers a shareable gift to the inferior, not only the two begin thereby to have something in common, communicatio in the first sense, which makes friendship between them possible, but it becomes fitting that the inferior respond to the initiative of the superior by doing whatever he can to help make actual the friendship to which he has been invited. For Aquinas, this communicatio of superior to inferior is precisely the kind of communicatio that God establishes with man in offering him the gift of beatitude. This offering by God establishes between God and man a kind of sharing, a sharing in final happiness, which establishes between them the kind of social context out of which friendship between God and man may develop. Aquinas writes, quote, "Since God communicates his happiness to us, there arises some communication between man and God, upon which some friendship ought to be founded. The love founded on this communication is charity." For Bobick, this third manner of employing communicatio is Aquinas' contribution to the Aristotelian discussion of friendship that Aquinas inherits. Whereas Aristotle rightly concluded that no communicatio naturally unites God and man, given their ontological distance from each other, Aquinas readily describes the communicatio supernaturally established by God in the Old and New Covenants. In summary of Aquinas' teaching, Bobick explains, though God and man are infinitely apart, infinitely unequal with respect to virtue and ability to delight and ability to be useful, they are nonetheless, or at least can be, members of the same social group. As members of the same social group, Aquinas teaches, God and man can become friends. The communicatio that God establishes with man enables man to conduct a conversatio with God. Bobick's survey of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio both enlightens and is enlightened by Deconic's survey of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good. Bobick's survey enlightens our understanding of Deconic's assertion with which we opened this essay. Others are not the reason for the proper lovableness of the common good. Rather, others are lovable insofar as they can participate in the common good. Though Deconic does not use the term, communicatio is the presumed reality upon which he builds his point. Deconic argues that the loving conversatio of family members is not the cause, but rather the effect of their lovable communicatio in the common good of the family. Accordingly, the friendship of family members roots itself not in some generous interior principle, as the personalists contend, but in the members' possession of one and the same common good, the good of the family, of which each member constitutes a part. Bobick helps us to identify the participation in the common good of which Deconic speaks as the communicatio that Aquinas highlights in his first manner of using the term. Conversely, Bobick's treatment of communicatio is illuminated by Deconic's treatment of the common good, particularly by the second of Deconic's quotations appearing in the introduction above. The communication with the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. Though Bobick does not specifically mention the common good in his descriptions of communicatio, Deconic helps us to see how Bobick constantly refers to the common good in those descriptions. In Deconic's account of friendly relations among persons, he makes clear that the communication of individual persons upon which their friendships are founded itself has a foundation. It rests on the, quote, communication of individual persons with the common good. The common good, the good of the person better than his particular good insofar as it can be shared, in its very shareability, establishes its beneficiaries in a social context wherein they may converse as friends about what they share. Thanks to their communication in the common good, individual persons communicate in a shared social context, out of which can arise the conversation of friends. On the handout that accompanies this talk, I include a number of quotations from St. Thomas in which he describes how nature provides several kinds of communicatio in which human beings can develop several kinds of friendship. What Aquinas helps us to appreciate in these texts is that the human creature is made for friendship, not simply because he is a knowing and loving creature, not simply because he has a soul or spirit, but because the world in which he lives is composed of a number of goods that throw him ineluctably into various societies with other human beings. And it is in these societies, constituted by the common good of the family, of the city, and even of the universe, that members come to know and love each other as friends. Thank you.
Okay, we're very grateful to Father Aquinas for an excellent lecture. And at this stage, we have some time for questions from our audience viewing live on Zoom, on YouTube, and on Facebook. So we're going to go first to a question on Zoom from Joseph Moynihan, who is coming to us from St. John's Seminary. So go ahead, Joseph.
Thank you, Father, for your talk.
Thank you.
Your discussion on the common goods remind me of a conversation that I was having the other day. I just wonder if you could speak to it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, given that there are different common goods sort of rooted in our human nature, like the political common good, mm-hmm. common good of marriage, family, all of which seem to conduce or are orderable towards the common good, universal common good, mm-hmm. God, could one do something which affected negatively their realizing the universal common good, but not harm a lesser good? For example, like the political order in trying to have religious pluralism flourish in order to have the political common good flourish, mm-hmm. actually end up thwarting the spiritual common good or even the progress towards the universal common good when, mm-hmm. say, false religion or irreligion are publicly promoted or privileged more than true religion, or for that matter, thwart the building up of friendships. Thank you.
Sure. No, that's a great question. So what Aquinas would say there is that God himself is the common good, right? The uncreated common good. He who in himself is the source and exhaustion, really, of all uncreated goodness. And that every created good, especially the common goods within creation, are created expressions, created participations in his goodness, especially in the diffusion of his goodness. And certain of those goods, the good of the family, the good of the city, the good of the universe, are going to express and kind of diffuse their participation in God's goodness to varying effects. And so we can talk about a hierarchy of those goods. You might want to start with the common good of the family, common good of the city, common good of the universe. From Aquinas' point of view, because they're all expressions and participations in God's goodness, all of those expressions are going to be related to each other, and that the lower are going to be oriented to the higher, and that the higher in some way are going to encapsulate without oppressing or squashing the lower, but that the flourishing of the lower is taken up into the flourishing of the higher. And so in some way Aquinas is going to say that the flourishing of the family is oriented towards the flourishing of the city, and that the flourishing of the city itself is dependent upon its reflection in some political way of the flourishing of the good and kind of the diffusion of the good within the entire universe. So, insofar as family is oriented to city, city to kind of the good of the universe, the good of the universe, obviously, to God, there's going to be some kind of orientation of the family, of the city, and the universe towards the ultimate good, God himself. And so Aquinas, in giving counsel to political leaders, for example, says that in some way, you know, their good prudence and good governance of the city has to manifest in some way their ordering and their directing of the life of the city to higher expressions of the common good. I don't think that anyone can deny that, even in modern political life, modern political realities. I think what occupies us, obviously, today is to what extent and how explicit does that ordering have to be for the flourishing of political life. And that's where we see a lot of the political debate, especially within the Catholic family centering right now. How explicit, you know, does the ordering of the city towards the common good that is God, how explicit does that need to be in order for the city to flourish as itself? And obviously there are different schools and that take different positions on that, over the question of how explicit. But it seems to me that's at least how Aquinas helps us to appreciate the question and to understand the various schools of thought at the current moment.
Okay, our next question comes from Zach Waters, who's joining us from Yale University. Go ahead, Zach.
Hi, thank you for your talk, Father. Would you mind elaborating a little bit more on the common good as a principle of love between the Trinitarian persons? What about the worry that something other than the Trinitarian persons themselves are the source of each other's love? And would you be able to talk as well a little bit more about social Trinitarianism and whether personalist errors might have anything to do with that kind of theology?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really sticky question. I think we have to make, and Aquinas equips us to do that, to make a lot of distinctions between kind of the life, kind of the, the inner life of the Trinity and the life of human communities. Whereas there are certain analogies there, you know, as we know, with every analogy, there's going to be greater difference than likeness. It could be the case that some might argue that in certain theological schools today, that there's too much, perhaps, in of alignment or too quick a comparison of human life with life from the Trinity. What ends up happening there is that we actually begin to project onto God the ways in which we relate and are our friends here, which would be certainly a corruption of our understanding of the life of the Trinity. I think one of the problems that DeConnick would see with the personalist of his day is that there's too quick an orientation too direct, maybe is the right way, orientation of human personality with divine personality, not taking into account all of the distinctions that make the human person as a creature distinct from the divine persons within the Trinity. That our life of goodness and even just the requirement for us to desire the good and to need the good for the augmentation and the perfection of our nature is something that absolutely does not exist, you know, in the Trinity. And so looking at the Trinity from models of human life, or kind of looking at human society as kind of indicating things about life in the Trinity, I think we should be really, really careful about. There's a lot more that can be said about that. I think what Aquinas would, I mean, he helps, I think, to set up the discussion that that only the Trinitarian persons are subsistent relations. The human person is not that. It's an individual substance of a rational nature who relates necessarily, but still as something accidental to his nature. And that's a huge difference, between the created person and the divine person. So I think any kinds of comparisons that we make between human society and Trinitarian life have to begin with, a mastery of that distinction.
Okay, our next question comes from Thomas Chivati, joining us from Cornell University. Go ahead, Thomas.
He's still on mute. There he is.
Father, thank you for your delightful and hopeful lecture. I want to ask a question regarding Gaudium et Spes and the documents that may help us to interpret it. Mm-hmm. How do we interpret it without saying that the common good is ordered to the particular good? How do we interpret it in a way that's not personalistic? So I'm thinking, for example,
when it says believers and unbelievers are generally in agreement on this point.
Right.
Everything on earth must be ordered to man as to its center and summit.
Right.
And I'm thinking of another aspect, which is related to the general theme of your talk. It often talks about the common good of the human family.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of communicatio are we talking about in this case?
Right. So let me, the first question is a good one. And here I think de Koninck offers a way forward here. What de Koninck, you know, when he sets up his critique of the personalist, he's not critiquing personalism itself or defenses of human dignity against especially threats of totalitarianism, which he's writing in 1943. This is the world in which, you know, he's writing and teaching and thinking. De Koninck says no, that in terms of fighting totalitarianism and really, really corrupt notions of the common good, though on the one hand, those corrupt notions are not to be defended, and secondly, it is helpful to defend a proper notion of human dignity and exalt a proper notion of human dignity to contend with the totalitarian threat. De Koninck affirms those things. What he doesn't like in certain personalist authors is the way in which they go about construing human dignity as something over and against what they see as the totalitarian threat or the totalitarian conception of the common good. What de Koninck doesn't like about that is that where he thinks that the personalist should, in terms of exalting human dignity, should have really gone after not the totalitarian concept of the person, but the totalitarian concept of the common good. That's where the root of their error lies. And so in Aquinas's evaluation of some personalist writers, that move, he sees, leaves on the table and tacitly accepts the totalitarian definition of the common good and then constructs a view of the person around that corrupted view, which for de Koninck then leads to a corrupted notion of the human person and human dignity. What de Koninck sees is that in the personalist argument that he dislikes, that if in the totalitarian view, the common good is something that can oppress and suppress the particular good of individuals, he sees what the personalists have done is simply reverse the order over and against the totalitarian presumptions of the common good. The individual's particular good is something superior then to the common good. That's what de Koninck, you know, doesn't like. And so he sets up a way then of understanding or describing how it is that the human person by nature is oriented towards social, political flourishing, because if you have a proper understanding of the common good as proper to each individual, and is something that's better than their own particular good because of its ontological makeup as something shareable by many at once, and how the pursuit of the particular good is oriented towards the flourishing within the political common good. I think that kind of gives you what you need then to read those texts of the Magisterium clearly and correctly. It's also to put those texts within the same world, really, that de Koninck and Maritain and Mounier and all the others are writing in. It's still a world that's threatened by totalitarian regimes, the success of totalitarian regimes, and the threat of the spread of totalitarian regimes, particularly in their suppression and oppression of individual persons and of particular and their particular goods. So there's a kind of rhetorical push, I think, in kind of mid-century magisterial texts that wants to remind, especially in the view of the totalitarian threat, that there is something about the city that should serve the human person. But I think from a Thomist point of view, to expand on that language is to see that the political common good is something that is to provide human not just human persons, but human societies, that in which they should flourish, not just individually or particularly, but commonly. And so I think that's certainly how de Koninck would push us to read those magisterial texts. And in the debate themselves, or the debate itself between de Koninck and those who are responding to him, they pick out certain texts from Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, and they present kind of conflicting interpretations of those. De Koninck showing, though, how he thinks those texts should be read, within the Greater Thomist tradition.
Okay, our next question comes from our own Ellie Brown, graduate of Princeton University and student at the Dominican House of Studies. Go ahead, Ellie.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. So my question is related to an earlier question. So one could argue that liberal modernity doesn't have a thick conception of the common good, but rather simply involves individuals choosing and pursuing their individual desired ends. So if this is true, it would seem that perhaps genuine friendship is more difficult to pursue and sustain in liberal modernity. So two questions. Mm-hmm. First, is this diagnosis correct? And what are the political ramifications of this? And second, how ought we pursue friendship well in our current social and political circumstances?
Mm-hmm. That's also a very good question that I think requires some distinctions. What I would say that in a helpful distinction in dealing with liberal modernity is to be quite clear, or to be very clear what we mean by that. And I think there's a distinction we can make between liberal structures of kind of governmental regimes and a liberal anthropology that might inform how those structures are in fact employed and exercised. The Dominican Order, for example, has within its own governing structure a lot of features that we would consider kind of liberal kind of structures. We've got lots of voting. We've got lots of electing. We've got lots of superiors. There's a great kind of division of power and kind of checks and balances that's put on the exercise of authority. Our superiors, like myself, are term limited to very short terms. Or we're restricted to very short terms. We're term limited to just two terms. So there's just constant exercise, constant turnover of the exercise of authority and sharing broadly the exercise of authority. And that's within a medieval order, you know. So that's an example I think of. We can identify what might be seen as more kind of liberal structures of governance that aren't informed by a liberal anthropology or a liberal kind of overly individualistic anthropology. And so if we can apply that distinction then to contemporary democracies, I think you can probably see that I think the argument can be made that in the American founding, for example, you did have a thicker sense. It may not maybe not perfect, but certainly thicker than we have today of the common good and less of a preponderance, I guess, what I would call a kind of of liberal anthropology, individualist anthropology that went into the forming of the governing structures of the country. There are scholars who can then kind of trace the development of American democracy from something that's more community oriented, especially in the way that communities were actually living together under the governing structures of the American founding, and that there's an increasing kind of individualization that overtakes not just popular culture but also academic culture, entertainment and things like that, what we find ourselves suffering from today. So I don't know, these are all big meta questions. I would say that in dealing with the current political landscape, I think it's to be clear, if we can't at the moment address the structural problems of governance, there is something we can do about the way we live within our communities and our families, our neighborhoods, that try to kind of eradicate from daily life the influences of a liberal individualistic anthropology and live as the social and political creatures God has made us to be, and to identify clearly what the good of the family is and pursue it. Identify clearly what the good of the political community is, especially at the lowest level, and pursue it. I think it's going to be, I mean, it could be. I mean, one argument to put forth is that it's going to be the experience of real common goods and the flourishing with real common goods within kind of at the local level that's going to hopefully lead to, or could lead to, correction, in regard to higher common goods. I do think, and this relates to a question that was asked earlier, size and distance and quantity does become a bit of a problem for the political common good. That the way decisions are made, or at least the application of authoritative political decisions are made, the closer those decisions are made and implemented to the lives of the people affected, the better. And so I think we can see that, as governing bodies become more abstract, and their governing becomes more abstract, the more alienated those decisions do at least feel in terms of the way people are living their daily lives. And it might be harder then to talk about concrete, solid, thicker, political common goods in that sense. I think for that reason, it was popular in the early 20th century for Thomist writers to really advocate or to put forward Aquinas as kind of a globalist in the sense of he was kind of a theorist of world government, or that the principles they articulates in the Summa and elsewhere lead us naturally to that conclusion. I have my doubts about that. I don't think that's explicitly contained in Aquinas or is a kind of a natural outflow from his thinking, at least in the way we would imagine how a global government would work, as opposed to something that's exercised at the lowest level. So that's maybe a little wandering and rambling, but a beginning of an answer that I would give to that question.
Okay, so with that, we've actually come to the conclusion of tonight's talk. We're very grateful to Father Aquinas for an excellent and illuminating lesson in friendship and the common good. So preview of coming attractions. A first note is, if you haven't yet, do subscribe to the quarantine lectures. When you do so, you'll get emails with updates and links for the different Zoom calls and YouTube and Facebook events. You'll also just get a link to download our Prayers in the Time of Plague, the plague prayer book that we put together, as a way by which to respond to present circumstances, including such things as a novena to St. Roch. You didn't know, but there is a patron saint of plague times, so we're grateful for that. Coming attractions next week, Tuesday night at 8 p.m., we have a lecture with Father Dominic Legge, the director of the Thomistic Institute, and he'll be speaking on, is it rational to believe in the Holy Trinity? And then on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation from quarantine with Father Basil Cole. That'll be at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, and he'll be talking about angels and demons, so a very popular theme, one that's actually garnered a lot of interest with our Aquinas 101 series. And then on Thursday at 8 p.m., we'll have a lecture given by me. It'll be called Born Broken, Aquinas on Original Sin. So you've got lectures to look forward to on Tuesday and Wednesday and on Thursday. Finally, be sure to join the Zoom breakout sessions at the conclusion of the webinar to continue the conversation both for students and non-students alike. So signing off from the Thomistic Institute studio here in Washington, D.C., good night, God bless, and thanks so much for having joined. We'll see you next time on the Quarantine Lectures.